And thank you, Ajahn Kavli, for the opportunity to offer some reflection. And actually, I'm aware that you've all been listening to a lot of Dhamma last week, a lot of Thai Dhamma and a lot of translations, sitting on hard floors and not sleeping much. Probably many people really looking forward to having some time alone today, and I appreciate that. I was thinking what I might be able to offer in terms of encouragement. A lot of the tone of what was talked about at Wat Nom Pophong was praise for the incredible standards and incredible practice of Lumpur Cha, and a lot has been said about that. I thought that what I could offer as something of a supplement would be encouragement about how to practice at Wat Nanachat now. Having been like you, someone who didn't meet Ajahn Chah and didn't train with Ajahn Chah, but who trained at Wat Nanachat for some years, a lot of the tone, which might not have been apparent of the talks from the wonderful Thai elder monks, wasn't so much things are really degenerating now and it's never going to be the same and in those days we were really doing the real practice. What the tone was more like, despite the fact that it was as that difficult, some days not eating at all, many nights not sleeping, not having medicine when you were sick, etc., what these venerable elders kept saying was they didn't experience it as being that difficult because they had such tremendous faith in Ajahn Chah. And they derived a great deal of energy and inspiration from his practice, and he led the practice. So a lot of those comments about how much more comfortable it is now, it wasn't so much an admonishment, just to kind of be aware. But there was a warning repeatedly that now that things are more comfortable, that we can get attached to comfort and not practice as hard, because in those days you had no choice but to practice with a great deal of discomfort. But anyway, I just thought I would, I'm sure Ajahn Kavli translated that, but I just thought I'd also mention that the stress that I heard was loving regard and awe for the sincerity of Ajahn Chah, who just put his whole heart into the practice, was absolutely determined to realize Dhamma, whatever the hardships, and the particular focus on keeping the vinaya as purely in spirit and in letter as possible, as humanly possible. So that incredible sincerity. Then, so what we have here at Wat Nanachat is a monastery that practices very good vinaya and which trains you to understand the vinaya. And having travelled a little bit, having spent some time in India, seen the various standards of monastics outside of our context, this is very rare and special. So knowing the rules that Lord Buddha laid down and being able to live within those rules should be a source of confidence and joy. If we can recollect it with gratitude and joy, that understanding that most monastic traditions these days do not keep these standards, and our tradition does, and that's something to derive confidence from. And then this lack of remorse, like knowing that you're not doing anything wrong, and you're living by standards that Lord Buddha felt monastics should live by. This is actually very nourishing. But we have to recollect that, the purity, silanusati, recollect the purity that we live by and rejoice in it. Because I remember very well, the first couple of years of training at Wat Nanachat, I just felt very oppressed and I felt like it was all a bit much. And just for perspective, now speaking, it's my 17th pansa, I was a novice for a year and a half. So 18 years later, I remember in the first year, probably 4 out of 7 days I wanted to disrobe. So why didn't I disrobe? And that's what I want to share with you today. And those 3 days out of 7, I would touch, qualities of joy and serenity that were superior to any kind of happiness I'd experienced as a layman. So what we have to bring to our training is a long-term commitment. And so I remember that it was a couple of years later that maybe it was only 2 days a week that I wanted to disrobe. So it wasn't the case that you have this feeling of this is definitely the right place, this is definitely the right, and that you're never going to feel like disrobing. It's that you have to see it in perspective and in context. When we first come to Wat Nanachat, we have to give up many things. Sex, masturbation, music, calling people you want to, when you know, it's a lot to give up for young men. A lot of sensuality. And then, so the craving that we've all made a lot of karma with swells up in the mind. And it does need to be starved. And that's a very unpleasant process. And nobody says that that's easy. And then what can happen is that your mind feels oppressed by your own kilesa, at least mine did. At least that's how I see it now in hindsight. That my own frustrated kilesas was experienced by my mind as oppressive. And that's normal. And this is part of what the Buddha talks about, taking the green wet stick out of the water and placing it on the bank to dry. There's a drying out process. And it's not pleasant. There's a lot of patient endurance that's required. But what can happen, and what I'm pretty sure does happen at Wat Nanachat, is we can perceive the external requirements as being oppressive. The core Wat, the meetings, and we can start to feel like it's the monastery that's oppressive, the core Wat that's oppressive, the vineyard that's oppressive. But actually it's not. Because if you train with it, as we're supposed to let go, and that's what the Dutangas are for as well, to actually let go of our defilements, the experience is of a more spacious, more radiant, more happy, more peaceful mind that lives within the same core Wat and the same vineyard. And then eventually, if the mind does become ripe and develop insight, people become completely liberated living within this core Wat and this vineyard, and they don't perceive it as oppressive at all. They just, as those great elder monks in Wat Phopong were describing, they perceive it as a very, very beautiful and noble standard that they honor and revere. So what we need to bring to our practice then is an element of faith, and then a lot of patience and a commitment to stick to it long enough. You see it as an experiment, and this is why we try to commit to a 5-year period as a minimum, to really see how this bhikkhu training works. And this is another thing about Wat Nanachat that I thought I would mention, is that it's such a sophisticated and complicated, complex place that exists in relationship to so many other things. It's actually impossible to really understand Wat Nanachat in 1 month or 6 months. I really think you probably need to live here for 2 or 3 years before you even know what Wat Nanachat is. It exists in relation to so many other things. And so we have to bring a quality of doubting our critical thoughts and doubting our doubts and be committed to a process with a long-term view. Something that I found enormously helpful within this process is learning to cultivate loving kindness for myself. And this was what Ajahn Anand's suggestion to me was when I was spending my second pansa at Wat Mapchan. He suggested to me to spend the first 5 to 10 minutes of every meditation session spreading loving kindness to myself. And originally I had a lot of resistance to that, but I could see he had a point, that I had spent quite some time suffering with some resentful thoughts as a one pansa monk, feeling that Ajahn Jayasura at that time wasn't particularly interested in me and didn't seem to care personally for me. And so I had a lot of pain around that feeling of the Ajahn doesn't care, the Ajahn isn't interested. And so the obvious thing about loving kindness is that actually you don't need to receive metta or care from other people if you learn how to offer it to yourself. And so I think it's important to acknowledge that we all have a need for metta. We all need a certain amount of nourishment. But what Ajahn Ananda's suggestion was to take responsibility, train myself in a discipline, and start offering that to myself. And I think it really is the case that if you can generate, permeate, radiate the warmth of loving kindness within your own heart, you're not going to resent other people if they don't offer it to you. It also makes you less reactive, less defensive to criticisms from others. So when others aren't offering loving kindness towards you, offer loving kindness to yourself. And you can do your vipassana practice and you can do your mindfulness practice. There was that harsh comment, painful feeling in the heart, aware of feelings. But then you respond, may I be well, may I be happy, may I be well, may I be happy. And you offer loving kindness to yourself, and this becomes something very nourishing. And if you really just commit to just that much, 5 or 10 minutes of every sit, and the other thing Ajahn Ananda said, very valuable advice, was to make sure that I did do some sitting every morning, every afternoon, every evening, every day. And that's enormously important, if you can. There are some days where it's not possible. We have a lot of duties sometimes, but most days it is possible. And so that's the time when you generate the sati, generate the clarity, incline the mind to collectedness. But if you also offer this loving kindness, and for the first 5 or 10 minutes, over a period of years, yet again coming to this idea of committing to a long-term project, over a period of years, that becomes something that you can do. You can offer loving kindness to yourself, and loving kindness starts with oneself as a samatha practice, and then obviously if you have the capacity to hold the kusala mindset of loving kindness within your own mind, then you have the capacity to radiate it outwards to others. And this is very important, and obviously we train in cultivating loving kindness to beings that it's easy to have metta for first, and then neutral beings, and then difficult beings. But as you train in that, it gets really interesting, and it's when you're having conflicts, you can actually radiate loving kindness to the people that you're having conflicts with. And then the conflict actually can become interesting. It doesn't have to be something that you react against. You don't have to go and criticize this person to all your friends. You can right there in the conflict radiate loving kindness. And this is like learning how to react skillfully to suffering. And this is very empowering. But it's one of those things that we need to make a committed discipline to before it actually develops some strength. And at the very least, to respond to your own suffering with loving kindness. It's a pleasant abiding. It creates a lot of merit. And it'll give you some of that joy that you need to sustain the holy life. The other thing I want to talk about is just to be careful about the mind that says it's too hard, it's too tired. When you come to do your daily practice, we all, the early mornings and the one meal a day, the mind can feel tired. But we really need to, in a way, fight the hindrance that lies to us and says it's better to sleep, you need to sleep. Because we just need to remind ourselves that in the world now, in the corporate world, and in people in private business, and people working for governments, many people working 8, 9, 10 hour days, many people very tired. And so actually even on a busy day, we do have more spare time than most lay people. And so we need to put up a bit of a fight. And so what it might mean is like sitting with the I'm tired, I want to sleep, it's too much, blah, blah, blah. Actually, we have to sit with that. Really important not to believe that. You have to sit past the tiredness and past the resistance to the meditation and just do it. And you might find that when you do rest after the meditation, your rest is more restful. If you actually let go of some of the hindrances, pacify some of the hindrances, don't believe the doubts, don't believe the aversions, generate some loving kindness, and put up a bit of a struggle, wrestle, and then if you really can commit to meditating morning, afternoon and evening, you will develop some samadhi and you will develop some metta, and those moments, it begins with moments, the moments of clarity and serenity which are superior to the pleasure that you used to experience when you're a layman, will be a source of nourishment. And if so, for myself, it's only 3 days a week that I really wanted to be here, but those moments of clarity, I really trusted them. This is what I want to cultivate. This is what I trust. I don't trust my kilesas. I don't trust the pleasure of worldly life. I do trust the pleasure that comes from keeping good sila, having freedom of remorse, having faith, having a refuge, and then having mindfulness and wisdom and samadhi, which is clear and serene. So I just really want to affirm that I think you're all in a very good place. I think that the process that you've committed to is very, very noble, very, very trustworthy. And I just encourage you to try to bring patience as well as determination and a lot of loving kindness. I've stressed that in this talk because for me it changed the holy life. It made my life as a monk much more joyful and much more nourishing. And it's a real gift. If you have loving kindness for yourself and for others, that's something that you can bring the community as well. So just encourage you to tap into the potential that you all have to generate these divine abidings and care for your holy life, care for your practice, care for Wat Nanachat. The only other thing I would say is to be really careful with criticisms of senior monks. It's okay not to understand things. It's okay to have preferences. It's okay not to agree with certain things, but it's important to understand that if you are critical of the people who are helping you, and I know that Ajahn Kevali just works very, very hard to keep this infrastructure going. And so, as in my day when I was a junior monk, I didn't agree with everything Ajahn Jayasari did, and now I look back in hindsight and I'm feeling incredibly grateful for what Ajahn Jayasari offered. He used to be able to describe Ajahn Chah's Kor Wat, and he had a great deal of faith in Ajahn Chah's Kor Wat, and he made it all make sense, and he lifted our level of faith, and I'm so grateful, because that was part of what helped me to stay. And so now I look back and I recognize that Ajahn Jayasari was incredibly selfless, working very, very hard, and I know why he couldn't offer care and interest to everybody, because he was overworked, and there was just too many people. So what I wanted in terms of personal attention, nourishment, care, well, everybody wanted that. And the Ajahn only had so many hours, and he had to get back to his kuti, and he had to do his own practice. And I just realized now in hindsight that my expectations were unreasonable. And I wanted too much for him, and whatever critical thoughts I had, basically, I don't believe them anymore, and I feel a great deal of gratitude. So Ajahn Anand has stressed, and Ajahn Kalyanu also stresses, that to articulate critical thoughts about senior monks is an obstruction to the arising of samadhi. So it's okay to have a critical thought, but in your practice of mindfulness, you know a critical thought is a critical thought. And it's okay to have your preferences, but you know it as a preference. But if you're living under dependence of a monk who works very, very hard to make this situation available to you, then it's important to be reluctant to criticize, quick to praise, quick to help, quick to forgive. Well, this is the work of a monk who's training in humility, that we let go of our reactions and we make the noble choices. We support the people in leadership positions. Okay, Ajahn Kevali is not an arahant, neither am I, neither is Ajahn Sakito. But 16, 17, 18, 19 years of commitment to these practices. And Ajahn Kevali can't follow his preferences. Ajahn Kevali can't get to go and live with this arahant and that arahant and go off to the jungle. Ajahn Kevali makes being committed to this monastery his practice. And it's a huge offering. I probably recognize it more than you because we're contemporaries. We're very close in punsas. So I know the last couple of years my life has been more difficult, more complex, because I'm now an abbot and I'm building a monastery. But I know that Ajahn Kevali's life is more difficult and more complex. So I have a great deal of mudita and a great deal of sympathy. And it doesn't mean that he won't have faults, and it doesn't mean that he won't make mistakes, and it doesn't mean that there won't be difficult days for him when his speech isn't perfect. But what you have to understand is that he's working very hard to help you, and has worked very hard, is working very hard, and plans to continue to work very hard. So the appropriate attitude is one of gratitude. And just recognize what I was saying before about what Nanatha being complex and sophisticated is. This place, because it has such good relationships with so many other places, opens up all sorts of opportunities for you. And so you can't see that in 1 month or 6 months or 1 year, but precisely because you are training in this monastery with very good standards, you will have opportunities to go and train in other monasteries with great teachers. Or if you do go on, like I have, pilgrimage and had excellent opportunities to practice in holy sites, you will know your vinaya and you will be able to maintain good standards while you're outside of the monastery, precisely because you trained in a good monastery. This is very, very precious. So it's okay to have critical thoughts, it's okay to be confused, it's okay to have preferences, but be really careful with articulating it, because speech makes karma. And if you do want to experience some samadhi, you don't want to make obstructive karma for yourself. So I just rejoice in all of your practice, all of your sincere commitment, all of the renunciation. Like I said, I think you're in a really good place, and then I hope that you make the most of your opportunity, make that commitment, do that practice every morning, every afternoon, every evening, and have that long-term commitment, and you will find that as the years go by that it gets easier and more rewarding. And so these days I don't think of disrobing, so that's after 18 years, I don't think of disrobing anymore. So I hope that you will also practice until you don't think of disrobing. Hey, well.